Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com. Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. Our focus today is going to be on cancer, and in particular, gastrointestinal cancers, and within that, pancreatic cancer. It's never good to get a cancer diagnosis, but one of the worst diagnoses to get historically has been a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. The reason for that is often it has, by time of diagnosis, it has already metastasized, and the treatments thus far have, in terms of chemotherapy and radiation, have been rather ineffective. We've seen well-known persons taken from us by this cancer, including actors Michael Landon and Patrick Swayze, astronaut Sally Ride, civil rights icon John Lewis, and most recently our beloved Alex Trebek. But there is some reason for hope, and our guest today is going to tell us more about that. Her name is Dr. Allison Ocean. I'm going to introduce her and one of her colleagues in a few moments. But first, I want to bring in Dr. Alan Fink and introduce Dr. Fink, who is on the line with us from Saco, Maine. Dr. Fink is a clinical psychologist, child psychologist, who received his PhD in psychology from the University of Minnesota. He was a professor for several years at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and then he and his wife moved to Maine many years ago, where he had a long career as a child psychologist there. He's going to tell us some of his experiences as a patient with pancreatic cancer. Personal disclaimer, Dr. Fink was my thesis advisor and mentor when I was at Trinity College. So I want to welcome Alan Fink. Are you there?
We're here, Lewis. Thank you.
Well, I'm very glad you're here. So it was about 5 years ago. You were apparently in very good health, living and enjoying life, still working in your career. And then one day, a sort of a figurative bolt of lightning hit. Can you tell us about that?
The funny part of the story is, again, you know, it was in a backdrop of feeling fine and also eating well, but it was the end of April, Seacoast, Maine, restaurants were opening, and I cheated myself to a very rich meal of seafood Alfredo. The next day, basically the color of my urine was like Coca-Cola, and I'll try to pick out highlights. Anything that anybody wants to go back to, I can elaborate on further. Went in on a quick basis to my PCP. He did a urine sample which showed the extreme coloration. I off the cuff just blithered that for a couple of weeks I'd, you know, had some digestive irritability, and I'm not sure whether that contributed to his decision to say, go over to the local hospital, I want quick lab work done, and I think I want the results pretty quickly. We did that. Within a couple hours, I got a call from him saying, go to the emergency room immediately. The liver numbers were astronomically elevated. And again, shortening a long tail, over the course of the next few days, inpatient scans and endoscopy, ultimately showed a blockage of a bile duct, which at first was diagnosed as, I think I have my term correct, cholangiocarcinoma. They put in a stent to relieve the blockage, and we're beginning to plan surgery. I opted for a second opinion and went down to Mass General to their biliary clinic, was able again to be seen pretty quickly, and opted to schedule surgery there. When they went in, and your medical folk will probably be able to expand more if it's relevant, they ended up performing an entire Whipple surgery, which my understanding involves partial removal of the pancreas, the gallbladder, the upper part of the upper intestine, the duodenum, and also a number of lymph nodes. They took out 30. The results with a pathology, a report coming back, indicated that it was pancreatic cancer. One of the lymph node tests came back positive, which unfortunately necessitated the rounds of adjuvant therapy of the chemo and the radiation, and went through that for the following 4 or 5 months, which was, in all honesty, a very, very difficult, trying period of side effects. One more chapter, I continued to get surveillance testing on a 3-month basis, and about 8 months after surgery, after all of those showing no reoccurrence, they did come up with a spot on a CAT scan and later a PET scan of some kind of a spot on the scans, which was in a location which they were not able to biopsy. Again, I opted for a second opinion at Mass General. This time it was through the oncology department. They had reviewed the scans, and I met with an oncologist and one of their cutting-edge radiation oncologists, who confirmed the concerns, basically laid out an option of aggressive treatment if I so chose, but with a very low probability of any long-term positive effect, and the obvious prediction of, again, a return to the real quality of life negative effects of the treatments. I was feeling good at the time. I think my wife and I had gotten resigned to thinking that, while timeline might be vague, prognosis would be poor, and I opted to not pursue treatment and drove back from Boston just with an expectation that within the next 6 months, maybe a year, things would begin to deteriorate, and, you know, there might be a round of clinical trial, but the outlook wasn't great. We continued with 3-month surveillance scanning. The growth never changed. We're up to now 4.5 years of that. My latest visits, my own oncologist in Maine, consultation with the radiologists, are raising the question of maybe it was never malignant, the reoccurrence, and we were talking about, something benign that was showing on the scans. And at this point in time, I'm feeling good, still on that surveillance schedule, but hopeful things will remain the way they are at this point.
It is wonderful news, and I think it's hopeful for people to hear that this is not necessarily always a death sentence. Obviously, you went through a very difficult time to get to this point. By the way, I want to let listeners know that this hour, if you have any questions for our guests or comments, please give us a call at 802-244-1777 or text us at 802-585-3026. Again, the phone number is 802-244-1777. So, Alan, if you would stay with us on the line, I do want to bring in now Dr. Allison Ocean, who's in New York City, and one of her colleagues, Miss Cindy Gavin. But I'm going to introduce Dr. Ocean first. Dr. Ocean, originally from Alexandria, Virginia, grew up in Alexandria, Virginia. She went to medical school at medical school at Tufts in Boston. Did her also undergraduate at Tufts, medical school at Tufts, and then went to do her residency in New York City at the WEILL, that's W-E-I-L-L, by the way, Medical College of Cornell University. She stayed there for her fellowship in hematology and oncology, and she's now faculty and active clinician at Cornell in New York City, where she joins us from. Dr. Ocean, welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here to educate everybody about a very important disease.
Well, we've just heard Dr. Fink, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But as the listeners know, I often ask our guests, medical guests, what drew them to their particular specialty. Oncology is a tough profession. You deal with a lot of life and death issues, and dealing with some of these gastrointestinal cancers, particularly pancreatic, is perhaps the toughest of the tough. What did bring you into the field and has kept you in the field?
So I was always fascinated in college in biology about the subject of genetics. And cancer is a discipline that involves genetics very closely because of the, you know, high propensity of having hereditary cancers. And also the way that cells grow and, you know, with DNA replication and all the genetics stuff that we learn about in biology and medical school, et cetera, I just was always fascinated with that. Maybe it has to do with the fact that I'm an identical twin. I don't know. But that was something that always really made me want to investigate things further and get into the science of why things happen, why cancer happens, why cancer grows, and the genetic aspects of cancer in general. And then how I got into gastrointestinal oncology was really through research interests. I had been in the lab of a colleague early on in my fellowship, and Dr. Wadler was a specialist in GI cancers, and it just fell into place that I would go into practice with him and study GI cancers, and that's how it all played out.
Now you have presumably your own lab and your own studies that you're helping run. Let's talk about pancreatic cancer for a minute. Can you tell us how many new cases in general in the United States are diagnosed as pancreatic cancer, and is the number increasing?
Well, in 2020, there were about 57,000 new cases of pancreatic cancer diagnosed in the United States. It makes it the 11th most commonly diagnosed cancer, but unfortunately, it is the third leading cause of cancer-related death. So the incidence of pancreatic cancer is indeed increasing, and it is soon to become the second leading cause of cancer-related death in the next few years. The five-year survival for pancreatic cancer achieved, I say that, you know, I can't believe I have to say achieved, but achieved a level of 10% of five-year survival just this past year. Prior to this, five-year survival rates were dismal, are still dismal, but were around 5 or 6% of a person living 5 years after diagnosis.
Do we have any understanding of why the incidence might be increasing? I mean, one of the explanations could be that we are doing a lot of CAT scans of the abdomen and pelvis for other reasons, but nevertheless, in an aggressive cancer like this, it's probably a true incidence of increase. Do we know why it might be increasing?
We have certain ideas about it. There's definitely known to be a connection between the development of new onset diabetes and pancreatic cancer. And this is the development of diabetes later on in life. Everyone's feeling fine. They don't have diabetes. They're going about their business. And then later on, they have new onset diabetes. And of all those people that develop new onset diabetes, about 1% of them will go on to be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And if you think about that, that's a pretty big number. About 1 out of 125 new onset diabetics will go on to develop pancreatic cancer. And so that is one reason why we're seeing more cases of pancreatic cancer as it relates to the development of diabetes, the increasing obesity pandemic that's existing in America. There's also a lot more known about heritable pancreatic cancer, and it's linked to genetic mutations. There are certain mutations that run through families that are linked to pancreatic cancer, including the BRCA or BRCA mutation, which is everyone thinks of as the breast cancer or ovarian cancer causing mutation, but pancreatic cancer is definitely implicated with that mutation.
People might remember of the Carter family, Jimmy Carter's family. There was a strong family number of pancreatic cancers in that family. I believe his brother and sister both died of pancreatic cancer. How frequently do we see these genetic mutations?
Yeah, so in President Carter's family, the mutation is a well-known mutation called CDKN2A, and it's also P16 mutation, and that is about 10 to 15% of pancreatic cancers are related to some kind of mutation or genetic syndrome. You know, the more we look, and now that genetic testing is actually standard of care for anyone diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, we have to get germline genetic testing. We are seeing it, we are uncovering more and more cases of it, but the incidence of pancreatic cancer that relates to these different mutations is around 10 to 15%.
Let me just ask you this. You know, we know in certain forms of breast, you mentioned the BRCA, and certain forms of breast and ovarian cancer are related to those gene mutations, and in those cases, women, and which predominantly affect women, some women have gone and gotten prophylactic mastectomies or oophorectomies. If you're a person with a strong family history of pancreatic cancer and you get screened for this gene mutation and you find you have the mutation, what are the options?
Well, we know so much more now about this because, in general, pancreatic cancer does not have a screening test. And that's why, as you mentioned early on, it's discovered when it's at its latest stage, when it's already metastasized outside of the pancreas and is no longer considered operable or curable. If someone has a genetic predisposition and carries a mutation that is known to predispose to pancreatic cancer, there are now screening studies that people can participate in where they get followed regularly with tests to look for pancreatic cancer. These tests include MRI scans and also endoscopic ultrasounds, which is a procedure that someone gets sedation and then they get an upper endoscopy to look down into the pancreas to check on the pancreas and see if there's any lesions there that could have grown in the screening time. There are various screening studies at most major institutions nowadays, actually. So if you're in a more remote area, then you should look into the screening studies that exist at the bigger city that's closest to you, because most likely they have a screening study. There's also a national screening study ongoing now that people can sign up for online called the Generate study, and what it involves is genetic testing for people who are known to carry a genetic mutation, for their family members to get tested for free to see if they carry the mutation. And if they do carry the mutation, then they are advised and counseled about ways to be screened, you know, if they indeed carry the mutation.
Could you spell that for us, that the name of that?
Sure. It's called the Generate study, and it's Generate, G-E-N-E-R-A-T-E, study.org, generatestudy.org. And it's a national effort that is sponsored by the Lustgarten Foundation, which is the largest private funder of pancreatic cancer research, as well as Stand Up to Cancer. It's a collaborative initiative to screen and genetically test patients that are family members of known mutation carriers.
So, all right, so exactly, that is where there may already be a family history, and you mentioned that anywhere from 10 to 15% of pancreatic cancer that we know now may be genetically based. What about general screening? You said there are no screens. Are there any biochemical markers or any relatively non-invasive studies that on either here now or on the horizon that may give us a better chance to diagnose this early when it's still in a much more curable stage?
Well, we will have something soon. Right now in development, there is a blood test that will pick up 8 different cancers by just simply submitting a tube of blood, and it runs through an assay, and they'll be able to tell if cancer is present. That's coming out probably within the next few years. It's currently in studies. It's called CancerSeek. It's the leaders in this research are at Johns Hopkins. But getting back to what the symptoms are, actually, because we don't have a screening test, mm-hmm. people need to know what are the symptoms of pancreatic cancer and what when should people think about this as a potential diagnosis. So we have to remember that people that develop any kind of back pain or abdominal pain that is new in onset is one, you know, early sign of pancreatic cancer. However, back pain is so common. It's the most common diagnosis why anyone goes to an emergency room. So, you know, not everybody who has back pain obviously has pancreatic cancer, but it's something to think about if you also have other symptoms like weight loss going on, like if you're all of a sudden you see jaundice, which is yellowing of the eyes or the skin, if you have a change in your stools, all of a sudden you have more loose stools or stools that are oily or greasy in consistency, that's a sign that you're not absorbing your food well, because the role of the pancreas is to secrete intestinal enzymes and pancreatic enzymes to help digest the food. So if the pancreas is sick, it's not secreting enough enzymes, and so your food can't get digested. And so when you have a bowel movement, you can see changes in the consistency of the stool, and that can be a symptom of pancreatic cancer as well.
We heard from, of course, Dr. Fink's symptoms were somewhat nondescript, and he certainly initially could have chalked it up to the lobster dinner or whatever else. But then as it didn't get better over the course of next 2 or 3 weeks, and as other situations developed, such as his dark urine, he became concerned, which was, and we're glad he did.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, you have to listen to your body. If you know that there's something wrong and you're not feeling good and you go to your doctor and the doctor does blood tests and nothing really shows up in the blood, you can have pancreatic cancer and have a normal blood, all these blood tests. So if you're not getting the answers as to why things are making you feel poor, then you need to continue to pursue with another doctor, or really, you know, just make sure that some medical professional takes your symptoms seriously and, right. and does a complete workup, because we some people, the more awareness that we have of the disease, the more likely a physician who doesn't see this cancer that often, because it is a rare cancer, it's considered one of the rare cancers.
You mentioned that it's 11th in terms of the number of people diagnosed with it.
Right, right. And so it's a rare cancer. So it's, so day-to-day internists, this cancer is not on their radar. So when patients go to see their internal medicine physician or their primary care physician, and they, for instance, get a new diagnosis of diabetes, the primary care docs aren't thinking, oh, you probably have pancreatic cancer. And they shouldn't be thinking that you probably do, but they should be thinking that that's a possibility. And to also take a good family history and make sure that you've asked, you know, the patient, is there, what is your family history of cancer? Do you have pancreatic cancer in your family? Because we now know about this genetic tendency that can exist with hereditary pancreatic cancer, which is not linked to any known mutation.
Thank you. Dr. Ocean, we're going to be back in about 2 minutes. Again, our number is 802-244-1777. Stay with us, and we will be back shortly. Second half of our show today on gastrointestinal cancers, but predominantly on pancreatic cancer, with Dr. Allison Ocean, Ms. Cindy Gavin. We have a caller on the line, Rich from Starksboro. Rich, you're on.
Good afternoon, doctors. I was interested in your show caught my attention. I wanted to ask some questions about pancreatic cancer. Your guest mentioned that you can have all these tests and that look okay and still have pancreatic cancer. Would that include, you could have a test that's okay that says that your vitamin A, D, E, and K are all normal?
That's an interesting question, because those are fat-soluble vitamins. Dr. Ocean, could that be a tip-off?
It probably is true that people can, who do develop pancreatic cancer, can have deficiencies in those vitamins, but that's not a test that we routinely check, you know, in the workup of people. If someone's, you know, losing weight and having a malabsorption type syndrome, then they do look into stuff like that. What's interesting, aside from all of those vitamins, is that vitamin D, in most cancers that I deal with, people tend to run low vitamin D levels, you know, leading up to their diagnosis of cancer, colon cancer, pancreas, stomach, etc. But we don't know as of yet that giving people back vitamin D and repleting it is takes away any kind of cancer association with having low levels of vitamin D. So we don't know that yet. But it's a great question, but it's not something we commonly check on. It's more, we check, you know, blood counts, liver enzymes, liver function, and then also, if anybody's having pain, they get a physical exam and then maybe need imaging studies to further work up the pain.
There's one marker, I believe the CA19-9, is it, that has somewhat specific to the pancreas, but how is that being used now?
It is not a screening test, because there are times when it can be elevated and it has nothing to do with cancer. So we use it once someone is diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. It's a blood test. We follow patients on treatment and check it every so often to monitor their therapy and see if it's going in the right direction. If it's elevated, it means that the cancer is producing a protein that we can detect in the bloodstream, and so that's what that CA19-9 marker is. About 15% of the population, interestingly, do not make the marker, even if they have pancreatic cancer, would not express that marker because of it has to do with the certain blood type of the person. The assay just doesn't detect it. So we sometimes check another marker called CEA, carcinoembryonic antigen, or some patients can have pancreatic cancer and just not make any marker at all. So we only can rely on imaging studies to follow their disease.
Dr. Fink mentioned, said that he underwent a Whipple procedure. Just very briefly, now that's a very extensive surgical procedure that is generally only done if they feel there's a chance that it has not metastasized to other organs and that there's a chance for a cure. Can you briefly describe the Whipple?
Sure. It's as you mentioned, it's a very intense operation that is really only done in experienced surgeons' hands because of the intricacy and extensiveness of the operation. So it's mostly done in major medical centers. It involves removing the pancreatic mass, which is usually in the head or which is the side of the pancreas that is closer to the liver. Masses that are in the head of the pancreas are commonly removed with a Whipple operation. They can also sometimes be in the middle of the pancreas. If a cancer occurs in the tail or the left side of the body, or the left side of the pancreas, then that is a different kind of operation. It's not as extensive. But the Whipple involves removing the area of the pancreas that contains the tumor, removing part of the duodenum, the small intestine, removing the liver, the bile duct that connect the liver to the intestine, and then rerouting all of the plumbing, if you will, the biliary plumbing, rerouting that so that people can digest food again and so that their bile health is restored again. So it's an extent, and the bottom of the stomach also is removed. It's a very extensive operation.
I think it's fair to say don't try this at home. let's talk about some of the new approaches that you're using in terms of chemotherapy. And I'm sure some of these, or if not all of them, are involved in trials. But I guess two questions. Number one, let's talk about some of the new approaches. And also, how do people and their primary care providers or primary oncologists decide when it's time to go into a trial? And how do they find the trials?
Okay. Wow. So the mainstay for treatment of pancreatic cancer up until the last decade, I would say, is chemotherapy, which is medicines that infuse through the veins and the goal of chemotherapy is to kill cancer by disrupting the ability of the cancer cell to divide. So it intercalates into DNA, and so that the cancer cell can't divide into daughter cells or baby cells and keep growing. So that's how that's the main way we treat pancreatic cancer is with chemotherapy. We also use surgery, as we mentioned, and also radiation as a way to kill disease. And just as Dr. Fink had mentioned when it was discussed that he had a possible recurrence, they were entertaining using a very specialized form of radiation that nowadays is becoming more of a standard of care for localized disease, and that's called SBRT or stereotactic body radiotherapy. And that's very, very precise, given radiation beams to the tumor if it recurs in a local area. We can only use radiation treatments if the disease is localized. It doesn't help disease that is spread or metastasized in multiple organs, because the reason why it spreads is because these cells are in the bloodstream. And so treating a tumor with radiation is not going to help the the blood is not going to treat the bloodstream, which is the cause of the metastases. So that's answering your first question. Also related to therapy, we're now testing new ways of dealing with cancer cells, such as getting at the metabolic needs of cancer cells, like the energy supply of cancer. Why cancer needs food and energy to grow. And so there are therapies now in testing. We have one trial open at Weill Cornell of a drug called SM88, and this drug is an amino acid that is an experimental amino acid that aims to get inside the cancer cell, and it tricks the cell in a way and to thinking that it's being fed with this amino acid as an energy source, but this amino acid is dysfunctional and cannot really feed a cancer cell. And so the cell kind of scavenges it and goes after it, and in doing that, proteins get disrupted, and the cell ultimately uses up its energy storage, and then it dies. And so that's a different way of
what kind of results are you seeing so far?
So what's very encouraging is that it's now in phase 3 trials. So if it's already in phase 3 trials, it's already gone through the rigor of clinical trial testing for phase 1 and phase 2. And phase 2 is where we show efficacy for the compound. So now it is in phase 3 trials, which means that it is a randomized trial. So patients who are eligible for the clinical trial, and this is actually for the third time someone is treated. The first time someone is treated, they may get chemotherapy. The second time, if the cancer comes back, the second time they're treated, they may get a different chemotherapy or go on a clinical trial. But this specific trial that I mentioned to you, which is called SM88, is for the third time someone is treated with metastatic pancreatic cancer.
So very, very resistant cancers.
Very resistant cancers, but the phase 2 data was very encouraging. And what was really very important to the patients is that the drug has very few side effects. So it's not like taking chemotherapy. There are essentially very manageable, very light side effects from this oral compound.
I'm sure, as Dr. Fink mentioned, it was not an easy 5 or 6 months when he was undergoing the treatment, and it's not for many people. How do primary care doctors or even primary oncologists in the community decide when to send a patient to clinical trial, and how easy is it or hard is it to get into one of these trials?
So most of the time the clinical trial search is conducted by the oncologist more so than the primary care physician. A primary care physician, when they're referring their patients for oncology workup, they really don't have the knowledge of what are the ongoing, open, available clinical trials. That's the job of the oncologist to sort that out. One of the biggest problems in pancreatic cancer is the lack of enrollment of patients into clinical trials, and less than 5% of patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer ever enter a clinical trial. And the only way we're going to get newer and better therapies and therapies that extend people's lives significantly is if we enroll patients in clinical trials. And we also do a dismal job of enrolling patients of color into clinical trials. We need to really put an emphasis, oncologists who treat this disease really need to consider clinical trial as almost a first line of defense, because patients who go on a clinical trial, at least the first time that they're being treated, they are guaranteed to get standard of care at a minimum, but then they can also get standard of care plus something else that could also improve their outcome. And so that's what we want people to know.
Let me just add that there may not be a number of oncologists listening to this show today, but potential patients are. And I think patients and their families need to advocate for themselves at times, particularly when we're looking at a cancer, as you said, that has anywhere from only 5 to 10% survivability at 5 years. So you don't have a lot to lose by going to a clinical trial with this particular cancer, whereas with other cancers where the standard treatments are actually much, much more effective, you know, going to a clinical trial may be a more difficult decision. We need to take a call in a minute, and also I don't want to ignore Miss Cindy Gavin. I'm going to bring in right after the call one of your colleagues. We have Jim from Brookfield.
Hello, Jim. Doctor.
Yes.
My question, I guess you kind of answered it. I had the Whipple operation 50 months ago, and my I've had CT scan and blood work alternating for the last 4 years, and everything has been fine. When they did my operation, the doctor said my margins were clear. So at this point, I have no symptoms except my last blood work, my what they call tumor markers, I guess the C19, went up some. And I was wondering if there was any hope if it was back. And you answered.
We can't always, you know, I know that Dr. Ocean doesn't want to give you specific advice. That's between you and your oncologist. But Dr. Ocean, he's about as far out as Dr. Fink has been, 50 months. Mm-hmm. If you saw a CA19-9 starting to go up in an otherwise asymptomatic patient who's had a Whipple, what would be your approach?
Well, we definitely don't ignore it. We have to figure out why it's elevated, and sometimes there are false positives, but it most likely would lead to a earlier scan to perform to see if there's anything that has come up in the past in the interim time. Another thing to highlight is that we are actively studying liquid biopsies, which are biopsies that look at circulating blood tests. That look at circulating tumor DNA. So this is a really novel approach to diagnosing cancer that we can't see on a scan. We can't see; it's too small to see, but we know it's present. Is using specialized blood tests to try to see if we can detect it in the bloodstream even earlier, and that may lead to an approach where you would scan someone sooner rather than later and to try to detect the cancer.
That sounds like a very exciting new development. Let me just, Ms. Gavin, you've been very patient, and now you and Dr. Ocean work together. You have a 25-year background history in financial services and in nonprofits, and you've been involved with some organizations that help support patients in New York City and I imagine beyond. Can you tell us just very briefly what your activities involve?
Sure, thank you. And thank you for having me on your show. I am the founding executive director of Let's Win Pancreatic Cancer. Let's Win was launched almost 5 years ago to fill an unmet need to connect doctors, patients, and researchers with the latest science-driven information on pancreatic cancer. So we're an online-only program. Our goal is to get patients to the best treatment options. We publish new content every week in both English and Spanish. And what is unique about Let's Win is that all of our stories and everything shared on the site is medically vetted and fact-checked by a professional. So we have three aspects of the program broadly. We hear from patients and they share their stories, like the patients that you have, the survivors you have on the call. And those treatment stories and survivor videos are really helpful to patients that are navigating this difficult journey. It helps them, you know, empower them, helps them educate them and explore different ways to get treatment options.
Are there ways in which patients can connect with each other and correspond with each other and share stories?
Absolutely. So often, you know, someone goes on the Let's Win PC site and they, you know, see a survivor or a story that resonates with them, and we connect the parties. We also serve as a communication vehicle to communicate all of the research and the promising science that's happening today. So we interview leading pancreatic cancer experts on their work, and it's really been a wonderful partnership with the medical community and the patients, because it promotes the great work that's happening.
Can you tell us the contact information for that, for the listeners?
Sure. It's Let's Win PC, LetsWinPC.org.
And in terms of fundraising, if patients are going to a medical center some distance from their home, I know you've been involved with the Ronald McDonald House in New York as well. What if a patient, let's say from Vermont, wants to go down to New York City to get treatment? That's an expensive proposition. Is there any support for those patients?
So directly, Let's Win does not support funding for, you know, patient travel. That said, we work with other partners. The World Pancreatic Cancer Coalition is a global effort for all the pancreatic cancer advocacy groups to work together. And we would match you up with one of our partners that does funding. Very often, clinical trials pay for expenses related to the trial. There's also opportunities today to get virtual consulting.
We only have a couple minutes left. Dr. Ocean, very briefly, has this year of COVID affected your studies? Have you been able to continue them, or has it hurt them?
Initially, in early 2020 to about the fall of 2020, all research activities were shut down because of COVID, but now it's back to normal, and clinical trials are ongoing, and COVID has not been an issue. And we don't want people to ignore their symptoms of if they're feeling bad, go to your doctor. Even in the time of the pandemic, you need to get evaluated. We don't want to diagnose cancer even later than we already do.
I'm going to have to close. I wish we had more time. I want to thank Dr. Allison Ocean and Ms. Gavin. I want to thank Dr. Fink for sharing his story. We want to wish you and Jim, our caller, continued good news with your cancers. I want to thank Dr. Ocean in particular for lighting a candle in the darkness of what has been a very difficult cancer. And on a personal note, I worked for many years with her father, Dr. Ron Ocean, who is now a retired general surgeon, not only a skilled surgeon, but one of the most dedicated, compassionate, and hardworking physicians I've ever known. So I think that he would be, I'm sure he is proud of you, and I'm sure that you learned about being a good doctor right at home.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you to all of you. I want to tell you, next week we're going to be looking at emergency medical services in Vermont, both land-based and air-based. These are the people that we see initially who have to, in our most emergent moments, we're going to learn about their training, their skills, and some of their stories. So please join us, and we'll take good care of yourselves and be kind to yourselves this weekend to others.
Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, brought to you in part by Age Well Vermont. the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. NorthfieldPharmacy.com.
The music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.